for to reflect upon the stately steppings of our Lord. Leave the theme of prophecy. Brother Gene has selected the Balfour Declaration as his subject. Brother Gene Burns from New Brunswick.
Scriptural reading is from Ezekiel, a familiar passage, Ezekiel 37, verse 21 to 28. Ezekiel 37, 21. And they say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whither they be gone, and will gather them on every side, and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all. And they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions, but I will save them out of all their dwelling places wherein they have sinned, and will cleanse them, and so shall they be my people, and I will be their God. And David my servant shall be king over them, and they shall all shall have one shepherd, and they shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. And they shall dwell in the land that I gave unto Jacob my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt, and they shall dwell therein, even they and their children and their children's children forever. And my servant David shall be their prince forever. Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them, and it shall be an everlasting covenant with them, and I will place them and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in the midst of them forevermore. My tabernacle also shall be with them, yea, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And the heathen shall know that I, the Lord, do sanctify Israel, when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore. Now this familiar chapter tells of a succession of events concerning God's natural people. It covers a period of time, but focuses on that time when Israel's hopes of becoming a nation are a reality. It tells of a regathering into the land, establishing them in the land, healing the breach of the divided kingdom, of establishing his covenant of peace with them, of multiplying them, and setting his sanctuary in their midst. These are all stages of one event, and that event is the kingdom. In volume 3, page 258, Brother Russell said, speaking of the coming of the kingdom, and I quote, "It is already coming down, coming into control. And as a result, we see the preliminary steps leading to the reestablishment of the old Jerusalem. And ultimately, the result mentioned in our Lord's Prayer will be realized. God's will be done on earth." Again, page 260, and I quote, "These wonderful promises will not be fulfilled in a 24-hour period, but during the millennial day. They had a marked beginning with the year 1878 as the result of the Berlin Congress of Nations." Unquote. Did Brother Russell change his mind on these matters? Quote again, volume forward of volume 3, 1916. "Scarcely a word of this volume would need to be changed if it were written today, that is 1916. His whole understanding of the great event of the kingdom was, and this is how we must understand the whole of Brother Russell's writings, otherwise we will find him to be contradictory unless we can take his overall comprehension of, and grasp of the subject of the kingdom. His position from first to last was this, that Messiah's kingdom has various stages of inauguration. And that's a quote from Brother Russell, too. It's 1964. There were many stages of inauguration. And I think in order to understand the whole of Brother Russell's writings and to see that his writings are harmonious, it must be understood that he looked upon the kingdom as coming in its various stages of inauguration. And he listed, of course, the raising of the saints as one of the first works of the kingdom. Now, if Brother Russell and saw the kingdom coming down, in a sense, from the Berlin Congress of Nations, and the Lord intervening in the affairs of the homeland of Israel and the establishment of that nation, revitalizing the Jewish hopes, which started in 1878 with the Berlin Congress of Nations, which you're familiar with, which really all that it accomplished was to enable the Jew to buy land in Palestine and for him to be, that is, to enjoy certain liberties in that land. That was the starting point. But other events followed. Brother Russell died before the Balfour Declaration. But this was one of the next major steps with regard to the moving forward of God's involvement in the affairs of the nation of Israel. And as you know, the Balfour Declaration was the declaration by Great Britain that promised to the Jews a homeland in Israel. Now, Premier Eshkol, and I quote, see this 1967 was the 50th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, and there quite this past year quite a number of articles have been written, and I've gotten my viewpoints on these matters largely from the people, the Zionists who are in Israel, and not from the rationalist Zionists who don't go to Israel, but they speak fondly of Israel. But these are the people that are in the land. Their viewpoints. And one of them is Eshkol, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol. He said, and I quote, "One development whose crucial character remains beyond question was the issuance 50 years ago of the Balfour Declaration. This was indeed an event of paramount national and international and historic significance. The promise it held out went far beyond the formal undertaking of the British government to facilitate the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. Implicit in this declaration," and this is where Premier Eshkol really feels its vital link was, the great contribution that it gave, is the promise of general international recognition of the historic rights of the Jewish people in Palestine, a recognition to be realized a few years later in a decision of the League of Nations, and then, of course, later in the partition of Palestine and the granting of the partition to the nation of Israel and enabling them to become an independent state. But this was the precursor of this, of all these other events. Now, the Balfour Declaration, of course, promised the Jews a homeland, but notice, it's important to appreciate these things. It promised a homeland to the Jews in the right land, that is, in the land that God had promised to Israel. But additionally, and this is what makes it, you know, you could have one coincidence, but you got two of these things that are involved. It promised it at the right time, after 1914. It happened in 1917. And the timing is even more significant than that. Well, the Jews did not that very moment become a nation. Yet, it became the groundwork from which that nation later emerged. Now we want to just look at the timing and significance of this event. The Balfour Declaration was made November 2, 1917, and at the time, it was not a world-shaking event. You wouldn't have found it headlined in the newspapers of the world. You might find it in a little paragraph on the back page. In one of the encyclopedias that I looked up on, it only had about a paragraph on the Balfour Declaration. It wasn't a world-shaking event at all from a historical standpoint at the time. There was nothing to excite anyone except a few Jews, and not only as a conversation piece, because few Jews took seriously any thought of returning. That's the strange enigma of it. But now, 5 days later, November 7th, 1917, the Russian Bolshevik Revolution occurred, shaking the whole world to its very core. Now, this was a tremendous event in history. And as a matter of fact, there's been no end of writing about what effects this has had upon the world since that time. And there have been no end of effects upon the world. But the Bolshevik Revolution came 5 days too late to prevent the Balfour Declaration and the promise to the Jews of a homeland in Israel. 5 days. Yes, the Balfour Declaration came 5 days before the Russian Revolution. Now, strangely, the plight of the Jews in Russia was the main argument by which the faint heart of the British were finally persuaded to give the Jews a homeland in Israel. That was the clinching, as it were, argument, the great suffering of the Jews in Russia. In 1914, some 120,000 Russian Jews had left Russia, most of them coming to the U.S., but it showed the pathetic plight of the Jews in that land. And of course, when the war erupted in the fall of 1914, it stopped the emigration out of the country of Russia, and those poor Jews were sealed, as it were, in that nation, and their plight was pitiful. Now, that's a strange thing, too. Up until 1878, no country wanted the Jew, but neither were they allowed to go back to Palestine, nor were they allowed to enter on a large scale other lands. But strange, after 1878, when the Lord starts talking in terms of bringing his people home and revitalizing the hopes of Israel, to return to the land that he was intending that they should have, at that very time, the world should begin to change its attitude and say that, well, your home is with us. You don't have to go back. And so the doors of this country opened, and we find that large numbers of Jews from Europe and Russia came to this country. And of course, in a way, we're glad for that. But from one standpoint, it showed that at the very time that the Lord was calling his people home, that others were, as it were, saying that, well, that's not necessary. You can make your home with us. And this was true also later in Germany. Many of the Jews flocked to Germany, to the Weimar Republic, and they were led to believe that this they had a shelter here, and they identified with the German government, and later found that it was only a trap. But now, in looking at matters in perspective, 51 years after the Balfour Declaration, I would especially remind our young people, who often are bubbling over with ideals and maybe are a little impatient for the kingdom, to learn a lesson from the Russian Jews and to ponder this lesson well. Let us go back to Russia before the revolution. Really, from 1874 on, a strange thing began to happen all over Europe. In that 40-year period, from our Lord's return, the forces that brought an end to the old world were born and became the great effective agencies in the world for world change. The forces of idealism, ideologies, intellectualism, and humanitarianism were conceived and became the tools of change in the world. And Russia was no exception. There were forces at work there. You know, everywhere in Europe before 1914, from 1874 on, and all the little pubs and taverns and meeting places, you would see little groups of men talking about different forms of government. This is while the kings were still ruling. But the seeds of change were there. Men were speaking in terms now of new concepts of government, of ideologies, of human ideals and morality and so on a scale that they had never talked about it before. Everyone was concerned with these problems, the man in the street. It was his problem now, and he was concerned with it. Somehow the world was becoming to see the light. Well, in Russia, there were forces at work too. But the Jewish minds in Russia, there were two basic divisions in the Jewish thinking. One was a very homely one, very simple one. It was Zionism. That is, to identify the people of Israel with their ancient hopes and with their ancient land, and to revitalize those hopes, and for the Jews to somehow return. There was another group of Jewish intellectuals for whom Zionism was, what do we say, it was kid stuff, something for a few people, altogether lacking power to capture the world's thinking. It was parochial. It was only for a few people, for a small handful of persecuted, a minority group that only affected a few people, whereas the Russian intellectuals were talking in terms, Jewish intellectuals were talking in terms of communism and socialism that were worldwide in their implication. Karl Marx had a Jewish father who turned Christian, and this made Karl Marx a bit passionate against religion later. Another one of the great intellectuals of the Russian Revolution was Leon Trotsky. He was a Jew who answered the call of the world of tomorrow, socialism. And many other lesser-known Jews were laying the groundwork of communism that would sweep the world and change the order of things. Lenin was an opportunist who used the men of letters like Marx and Trotsky to rise to power. He wasn't an intellectual, but he was a ruthless politician who needed a platform, who needed men of letters, and he used the men like Trotsky and Marx to provide the ideological force that he needed to come to power. Now, among the Jewish intellectuals, a tug of war occurred. Cosmopolitan socialism for all people gradually came to be a predominant theme of Marxism. Zionism for the souls of Jewish youth was the loyal opposition in the tug of war. Zionist debaters had to withstand the sweeping claims made by socialists, and especially by the Marxists, who offered the Jews and all the world the great panacea and ultimate remedy for human government. Why not? Marxism, after all, took all human society in its embrace, and most important, not by and by, now. All human history was its arena. The Jews who took up with Marxism tended to look down upon Zionism for their parochialism, their preposterous self-limitation, their backwardness, their nationalism. These were all small things, and they looked down upon them compared to the magnanimous and great opportunities that the communist concepts afforded. All these things were so devastatingly petty. It required great character and devotion for many of the early Zionists in the debates that raged between the two movements for so many decades to insist on the really quite simple-minded proposition that they chose to remain Jews, and that their hopes and the hopes of the world could best be served by their maintaining their position as Jews and identifying with the promises of their old tattered Torah. The Marxists, after all, they did not have verbal magnificence alone. They had science in their pocket, right there. And all of history, too. Marxism had all the ingredients of a modern religion, one that encompassed all men everywhere. And its two great selling features, you know, salesmanship is based on two important things. It was new. It was now. Now that's what counted. And that was a force to affect the world. Science, history, and atheism had no bounds, no parochial limitations. It was rational, so its devotees claim. It fused intellectuality and idealism in a way calculated to move the masses, and so it did. Against this impressive array, the Zionists had to be strong-minded men to hold up their heads. But under the leadership of Theodor Herzl, they kept their heads up and moved to fulfill a role in the plan of God that seemed so unworthy and pathetic to the world-minded Jew. But now, how wide the chasm yawns between events and ideas, between ideas and reality. The Bolsheviks took power, but they had an unrealizable idea, an idea, moreover, that they did not have the smallest intention of even trying to realize, since it was held by all Marxists tradition and common sense to be manifestly unrealizable. It was a bill of goods that was suited for the appetite of the ambitious, the proud, and the godless. It was meant only as beautiful, high-sounding word imagery that could enchant the hearts of men, but it could never gratify the believer with fulfillment. Every revolution needs its word imagery, it means its man of letters, and so these ideas of Marxism and Trotsky were used to motivate people, to sell them with unrealizable ideals, and they bought the bill of goods. 51 years later, let us look back at the Balfour Declaration and the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution accomplished not one of the dreams of its proponents. Ironically, the Jews who fathered socialism and communism created an enormous trap for all their fellow Jews in Russia. The revolution was to assimilate all men into a common estate, but the Jews remained underprivileged and persecuted. Their liberties to return to Israel were stopped the day the revolution began. The Jews were sealed inside of Russia, where they remain until this day, and the only hope that they have is the hope that Jeremiah says that he will bring his people from the land of the north. God will intervene to save them from that land and bring them again to the land that he has promised. That's their only hope of escape. It's in God's promise. Isn't that ironical? Now, Israel is the sole rallying point for the communist world of Jewry. It must be deeply embittering for many of the Jews living in Israel to be forced to contemplate the perversion of all the ideals of the Russian Revolution, and forced to witness not merely the anti-Israel political tactics of the Soviet government, but the anti-Semitism so now widespread in that country, which is, by the way, to be the land of all comrades and fellow travelers, which the Jews never had a part in, at least only in a token form. And to those Russians who despise Zionism, those Russian Jews who despise Zionism as parochial and narrow, just a small-time dream for a few people, it may be a consolation to them now that many of the ideals of the Russian Revolution, what may in fact be called its human core, has now been transplanted to Israel and is thriving there. And so to our youth I say, don't be fooled with all the magical exaggerations on every hand in our institutions of learning. Not that there is necessarily something specially wrong with all these visionary exaggerations, but they are not realizable in a world of sin and evil under present evil conditions. On every hand there is a pouring forth streams of ideas and ideologies and concepts of liberty, unloosing moral restraints, ingratiating the pride of men, fostering false hopes on a colossal scale, which, of course, can only lead to great disappointment. The ideals and desires that have captured the minds of men are mostly proper ones. There's nothing wrong with them. These are the things that men were created originally to have and shall have. The lightnings of the Lord have enabled men to see the things that man to abide in honor and dignity must have. But no group of men or nations or institutions can bring a fulfillment of desire to all mankind under the present evil conditions. And that, to our youth, I say, is the difference between our concept and the world concept. They share many of the ideals of the kingdom in their ideologies. But these ideals cannot be realized apart from the kingdom, and therein lies their folly and will bring their disappointment. Going back to Balfour now. Sir Charles Webster, the outstanding diplomatic historian of England, said, and I quote, "It is my opinion, the greatest act of diplomatic statesmanship of the First World War. That period produced several great leaders of small nationalities who obtained much for their peoples when the world was transformed by the conflict between the great powers. But none of them, in my view, can compare in stature with Cham Weizmann." Dr. Weizmann was the man who gave the Zionists their practical leadership in securing Palestine as its homeland. And we would also add that it seems Brother Will Hollister once said that Theodore Herzl reminded him so much as a parallel to the Jewish movement as to what Brother Russell was to the Truth Movement. And I would only add one additional feature, that is that it took two men, really, in the Jewish picture to give the leadership to the natural Israelites what the Lord had in one man in Brother Russell. It took both Theodore Herzl and Cham Weizmann to accomplish the events that were to be accomplished, which we'll get into a little further. But we'll start with Herzl, because he was the forerunner of Zionism. In 1896, Herzl came out with a book entitled The Jewish State. He called on rich Jews to call a Congress of Jews and began laying the ground for Zionist hopes. And the book was a great success, but not from the expected sources. He thought the rich Jews would spearhead the movement. Well, he was wrong. Very wrong on that point. It was the poor and the oppressed Jews all over Europe that rose to the appeal. And Zionism came to bloom after this. And now Herzl was wonderful in his vision and faith, but he was somehow out of touch with reality, the way matters actually stood. He thought, and I'm kind of trying to group a great deal of history in a few words, maybe oversimplifying it, I stand that risk, but you get the thought anyway. He thought that on one side there were rich Jews, and on the other side there were Turkish officials who took money. And that was a simple problem then. One would offer certain advantages to the Turkish government and the Sultan, and the rich Jews would do certain things for them, and this would bring the poor Jews to Palestine. A very simple plan. But it wasn't basically correct. The Turks, with all his endeavors to negotiate with them, gave neither a yes nor no. And if they had given a yes or no, it wouldn't have meant much. They had no interest in doing anything for Israel. There was no basis either for confidence in the rich Jews and their generosity. That was another mistake. But Herzl had a naive trust in people and was very often disappointed. When the Kishinev pogrom and severe persecution meant literally death for thousands of Jews who had to flee with no place to go, Herzl was ready to accept the British offer of land in Uganda. He was humanitarian. He didn't want to give up the land of Israel, but here were Jews who were stuck, no place to go, they were being persecuted, and so under the great duress, Herzl was willing to accept the land of Uganda for a homeland for these persecuted Jews. Well, Herzl's face turned white when the 6th Zionist Congress said no to Uganda. They voted it down completely without giving it a second thought. But it was then that he realized that Zionism had to be tied to the land of Palestine. After all, the Jews had suffered so much. A few thousand more Jews dying meant nothing. They had to have the land that was promised to them. And he realized suddenly that now there could be no other land for the Zionists but Palestine. And so from that day and forward, Palestine was the only land that the Jews could ever be satisfied with. Now, we could say other things, but we must pass on. The difference between Weizmann and Herzl was this. Weizmann formed the first opposition to the distinguished Zionist leadership of Zionists, of Herzl and his colleagues. And as a member of the Democratic fraction, which included Leo Motzkin and others, Weizmann demanded, in opposition to Herzl's political viewpoint, that practical work began immediately in what they called Eretz Yisrael. That was the land they had their eye on. It was a part of Palestine, the land which they really have now, or parts of it. And he wanted them to start work in there under any and all conditions that were necessary to get the Jews back legally or illegally. He was working to get them back legally, but whatever was to be done, they had to start work there now. They had to begin to be building, as it were, at both ends, not to build a bridge over on one side and not up the other. And this view apparently was a correct one, and it was the view really that brought about the realization of Jewish hopes. They had to build at both sides. Now, Weizmann engaged in a diplomacy of persuasion. How did the Balfour Declaration come about? Sometimes we tend to oversimplify things. I think we always do, in most cases. Weizmann, of course, you're all familiar with the fact that he was a great scientist as well as a statesman, and he had found a way to synthesize acetone through a bacteriological process of some kind, which I guess is the forerunner of most of the ways that we synthesize so many of our drugs today. He had found a way to produce acetone through taming certain bacteria, and acetone was necessary to the war industry. It was used in gunpowder and other areas of the war industry, and Britain was embarrassingly short, and the whole Allied camp was embarrassingly short of this ingredient. And so some feel that, well, all Weizmann did was come along and say that, well, I'll give you acetone, the way of making it, and you give us the land of Israel. Well, that's very simple, but it wasn't that simple at all. Weizmann worked behind the scenes in Great Britain for 3 years to accomplish the Balfour Declaration. He engaged in 2,000 conversations with British statesmen and politicians in the 3-year period preceding his victory. You know what that adds up to? About three interviews a day with British politicians and statesmen. So he must have been on the job. Three a day, an average. He wrote 1,000 letters in the same three-year period before he arrived at the Balfour Declaration. This was done, mind you, while a titanic war raged in Europe. And the suffering of the world was so great that why should the British Parliament be concerned with the suffering of a minority group in Russia? The whole world was bleeding. Why worry especially about a few Jews who were bleeding in Europe and particularly in Russia? Now, Balfour, strangely, himself was a bit anti-Semitic. He didn't grant this because he loved the Jews. He was anti-Semitic. Weizmann said, he, Balfour, told me how he had once had a long talk with Cosima Wagner at Beirut and that he shared many of her anti-Semitic postulates. And Weizmann pointed out that we too had drawn attention to the fact that Germans of the Mosaic persuasion were an undesirable, demoralizing phenomenon. These Jews had built up Germany and had contributed much to her power at the cost of the Jewish people as a whole, whose sufferings increased in proportion to its desertion by its most active elements. And here we see that actually it was true. In both wars, the great intellectual minds of the Jews had helped forge the war machinery of Germany. And their cooperation with the Jews had led, the more they identified with the German nation, the more it led to the suffering of the Jewish people. Of course, later on, when the machinery got started and Hitler took over, then the Jews were curtailed. But they had contributed much to making Europe the great intellectual, Germany the great intellectual nation that it was. Now, Richard Crossman, who is Lord President of the Council and leader of the House of Commons of Britain, says, and I quote, now some of the men of the world have rather shrewd insights. He says, though it was not realized at the time, the year of the Balfour Declaration proved in retrospect to have been the last year of the epoch of unquestioned white European ascendancy and the first year of the epoch of the anti-colonial revolution. In fact, he says, from the very day the Balfour Declaration was pronounced, the notions of imperial trusteeship and white man's burden in which it was encapsulated were to be threatened by two competing world revolutionary forces, class war and colonial revolution. Thus, the Zionist wave which Cham Weizmann aroused in the world, in world Jewry, was to move from the start against the stream of history, was to come into contradiction with currently fashionable ideologies, and in particular to clash with the principles of Russian communism, unquote. Now, it is remarkable that matters should so develop that it should emerge that at the very moment when Israel was recognized to have historic rights in the land of Palestine, and they were promised a homeland by the British in Palestine, that at that same moment the Jewish nation and the Jewish people should be divorced from the Christian world and its colonial empire, its colonial background. It was neither a part of the colonial world, nor was it a part of the communistic world, nor was it a part of the anti-colonial world. It was not anti-black, it was not anti-yellow, nor anti-white. The nation of Israel was born as an independent nation with no nation really its special friend, which is friendly to many nations, but it really has no one nation that it can count on as its steadfast ally. Now, we look at the Jew himself in relation to the Balfour Declaration. The immediate effect of the news of the Balfour Declaration was electrifying upon the Jews in the midst of the world of war and revolution. It awakened for the moment messianic hopes. It opened the gates of Eretz Israel and presented Jews everywhere with opportunities for returning and establishing a national homeland. But world Jewry was not prepared for the immensity of the victory that divine providence had given them. Just as when Cyrus presented the Jews the opportunity to leave Babylon, few were prepared to receive the favor afforded. Somehow, the Jew thought that the Balfour Declaration was eternal, and that from now and forever, any Jew that wanted to could go back to Israel, and that there would be a land there for him, and that the British would guarantee a homeland of the Jew forever, and they could go back whenever they felt like, and that the matter was settled. There was now the opportunity for a homeland in Israel. But the Jewish leaders knew better than that. Ben-Gurion himself had great vision. Hear what he said at this time. When the Britain had given the Balfour Declaration, he said, "It is not in England's power to return our land to us." And he was right. Not because the land is not or not yet in her possession, but because it will not be ours even with their consent, and even if all the nations of the world agree to it. No people can establish title to a land except through its own toil, creative effort, and settlement. The Hebrew people itself must transform this into a living fact. We must return the people to its land. We must establish a Jewish majority in Eretz Yisrael within the next 20 years. This is the crux of our historical situation. He was being prophetic in those words. Ari Pinkus, agency executive, said, "Between 1917 and the Churchill White Paper of 1922, severing Transjordan from the Jewish national home, there was abundant room for fast and widespread colonization of the Jews in Palestine. But the LA, that is, the Jewish returnees, came in trickles, and the small numbers spread out over the years could not prevent the consolidation of Arab antagonism and British complicity. This failure made it easy for the British to highlight the fact that Transjordan was not essential to Jewish national aspiration." And the British were the first to see that because of the slowness of the Jews to return to Israel, that the Jews didn't really need a homeland after all. This was their valid observation. Here they had given it, and the Jews were not returning in large numbers. Weizmann saw the absolute necessity of a mass return on an immediate basis, and even Lord Balfour, after the declaration and the decision on the British mandate at San Remo conference, he told Weizmann, he says, "Now you have got the signal to start, but you yourself must do the running." In other words, they couldn't just give the land of Israel to the people, the Jews, on a platter and say, "Here it is." All they could do is open the door and let the Jews in and establish a homeland. That's what he's telling them. But the Jews were not prepared on a large scale to do this. Nahum Goldman, president of the World Zionist Organization, said, "This aspect of the Balfour Declaration should serve as a lesson to our people for all time. For many years we relied on Great Britain to present us with a Jewish homeland on a platter. Hundreds of thousands of Jews might have been saved from Nazi annihilation if the Jewish people had used the opportunity given it by the Balfour Declaration from the beginning and utilized the facilities it granted to build up the Jewish homeland. This was particularly the case in the first decade after the signature of the Declaration, when British policy had not yet become so pro-Arab, unquote. It must be remembered now that Weizmann had secured the Balfour Declaration while a titanic war was raging in Europe, that he had secured the attention of the British Parliament to give the Jews a homeland. And at the same time, it must be remembered that Weizmann was a minority of the Jews. That when Balfour, as it were, yielded to Weizmann's goadings and his proddings and his entreaties in granting the Balfour Declaration, that he was really yielding to a minority of the Jewish people. The great Jewish world-minded people were bitterly opposed to the Balfour Declaration. And one of the Jewish leaders of Parliament, Montague, fought violently. He was a Jew, and he fought violently against the Balfour Declaration. Like in Russia, the world-minded Jew was his own worst enemy. Balfour really favored a minority viewpoint when he gave this concession, and we look upon it as really the Lord's divine intervention to secure this for his people. Well, now, of course, we've been saying how the Jews did not avail themselves of the full opportunity, but we don't want to leave the impression now that the Balfour Declaration was a failure. By no means. It took time, but the door it opened and the hope it enkindled succeeded in bringing the idealists and the pioneers back to Israel in a slow, continuous stream until in 1948, 650,000 were there, enough to successfully stand as a nation. And we must admit also that the Jews that did not go back, they helped establish the homeland. It was, we believe, to a large extent, the financial assistance that the Zionists who did not go back, who were sympathetic with Zionist hopes, who gave money and their support around the world to Zionism, they also helped to make this nation. And so we don't want to minimize what other Jews have done toward the Zionistic hopes. But there are two things outstanding about the Balfour Declaration. First, the Balfour Declaration was the root from which grew the political victory in 1947. Without Balfour, we do not think that the partition of Palestine and the birth of the nation would have been possible. This was one of the steps, as the Berlin Congress of Nations was necessary to revitalize the hopes of Israel. The Balfour Declaration crystallized those hopes, and at the time in which the world right to world leadership was ending, when they were being, as it were, disenfranchised from their rulership, at this very time, they made a historic concession that God's people had a right in the national homeland of Israel. That was the timing of it was beautiful. Since 1917, the Jews and the free world have been and are missing the boat. This is the second point. Despite the lesson of 1917 and the Holocaust of Hitler period and the rebirth and development of the nation, the Jews who are living outside of Israel are not giving themselves fully to Israel. Like the Jews of Russia previously, they are trying to give themselves to the world with no success. The Jews have been trying that for quite a while. They've been trying to give themselves to the world, but never alleviating the sufferings of their people. They should be giving themselves to the hopes of Israel. And we would like to ask ourselves, as spiritual Israelites, are we trying to give ourselves to the world or other interests, or are we giving ourselves to the interests of spiritual Zion and the hopes of spiritual Zion? I think we can learn a lesson in contrast, because there is a certain kinship between the natural and the spiritual. Now we come to the Arab question. There is always the moral question raised. Is God unfair to other nations in giving the land to Israel? First, our study of prophecy as Bible students leads us to believe that since 1914, no nation has unqualified right to its land. All land possessions shall be declared invalid in subsequent stages of the inauguration of Messiah's kingdom. There's no scrap of paper that any man can write or any nation can write that will be valid for a long period of time. The whole earth and its wealth will be redistributed equitably to all people under the great King of Glory. No one will have right to any land claims unless it is assigned to him by the great King. And by divine promise, the land of Israel must go to the descendants of Abraham. There can be no debate here. Yet the return of the Jews to Palestine has been remarkable. It gives us insight into the ways of God. The Lord had allowed Palestine to deteriorate since the Jews were scattered over the earth. In the 2,000 years that has transpired between events, little building has occurred in this land, and the inhabitants are few. Probably at the time that the Jews started going back, there were no more inhabitants in the land than there were in the days in which they were dispersed. Other capitals had become wealthy metropolises, but Jerusalem remained a sleeping city. The papal powers coveted Israel and Jerusalem with fanatical passion, and were prepared to pour the wealth of the world into that city if they could but have it. They would have made its streets into gold, and they would have made its gates into pearls, and they would have transformed this into a great city if they could have had their heart's desire to have Jerusalem. But the answer was always null to them, and they didn't succeed in any of their desires. And then the Mohammedan, the Ottoman Empire, rose in all its splendor, and they possessed the land that Abraham had been promised and his descendants. And yet, in this time, there were few edifices that were raised in Israel. It still remained a sleeping land. There's only the one great edifice that has been built there, and that's the Dome of the Rock that's worth mentioning. The Zionist hopes were initially conceived with the idea of building the lands not inhabited by the Arabs. And that's the beautiful thing. When the Zionists talked of going back to Israel, they weren't talking of pushing the Arabs into the desert and taking their homes and their houses and their land. They always spoke of taking the lands that were wilderness and building these up. They took the desert and waste places. And even today in Israel, land is too precious. They don't build their cities on good land. They build it on the rough terrain in the mountains, and they cultivate the desert, turning it into good land. Well, someone will raise their eyebrows and say, well, what about the 400,000 Arabs who left Israel in 1948? They suffered, yes. But they were not driven out. The Jews had entreated them to stay. They were promised that they would have their properties and their holdings would be secure, and that they would be treated with respect, and that they would have a place in Israel. These Arabs left on the promise of the Arab leaders that the Jews would all be driven into the sea within a few weeks, and that after the Jews were driven into the sea, that they could return and not only have their own lands, but they could have the lands of the Jews. And so they believed a falsehood, and there perhaps their greed entered into the matter. And so, but what we forget about in this story is that while 400,000 Jews had left the land of Israel, what we overlook is that 500,000 Jews left Arab countries. And the Arabs could easily have remedied the plight of those who left Israel by turning over properties that were left behind and confiscated. But the Arabs didn't lift a finger to alleviate the suffering of these 400,000 Arabs who had left Israel. They left them there in a no man's land. It was a cruel political strategy to leave these poor people in wretchedness for the whole world to see. They intended to use the misery of these poor refugees as a basis for hate Israel propaganda, and also as a means for collecting foreign assistance and aid. And so their suffering was not caused, really, by the Jews or by the Lord's giving the land to the Israelites. It was caused by the Arabs and greedy politicians. Also, the world has forgotten that 6 million Jews were murdered and their properties had been confiscated. Untold billions of dollars in money were grabbed by private individuals and nations that the Jews once possessed. Only Germany made a token war reparation in Israel. What about the rest of the European nations and the peoples who took the properties of these destroyed Jews? And now, as we look back, we begin to see that the sin of covetousness entered in the destruction of the Jews. They could do Ahab did. You know, Ahab, when he wanted Nathan's vineyard, what did he do? Well, he didn't do it directly, but he had Jezebel do it. And Jezebel had somebody else do it, but she had Nathan killed and his family. And so after he was slain, Naboth's vineyard, why, Ahab went in and he took the land, and so the prophet met him there. And he says, "Hast thou killed, and wilt thou also possess?" There were two sins here. He killed and he possessed. And so the Christian nations, in this complicity, they not only destroyed 6 million Jews, but they absorbed the riches. And these sometimes are the first nations to say, lift their eyebrows and say, "Well, now, what's happening here? It's unjust for the Lord to give the land to the people of Israel." Well, our time is up, and I must catch a plane, so I can't tarry. But I will say that before I get to my concluding scripture, that the return of the Jews to Israel was in proportion to the persecution. For instance, in 1918, some 4,000 Jews returned. Now, these are Ben-Gurion statistics, there may be others, but in 1925, about 34,000 Jews returned. 1931, about 4,000. In 1932, 10,000. This was already the Nazi influence. 33, 30,000. 1934, 42,000. 1935, 62,000. They were really flocking back there then. And the Lord, of course, was bringing His people home. But now, in conclusion, how do we relate these matters? Well, of course, as we open, they are part of the inauguration, stages of the inauguration of the kingdom. But in Hebrews, the 9th chapter, the 15th verse, we read, "And for this cause He is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called..." Now, who are they which are called? Brother Russell shows that this was the nation of Israel, the people of Israel. "That they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance." And so we see the steps now that the Lord is taking toward fulfilling the calling of the Jews and giving them the preliminary steps in giving them their eternal inheritance. And our King is marching grandly on.